So yeah, so we want to continue on with Ephesians 5. Last week, we were talking about walking in love or living out or reflecting the love, or what does it look like to live a life that reflects the love that we have received from Christ, from God. And then this week, we're looking at verse 8 in particular, although we're going to look at the whole passage, but we're going to land on verse 8 as our sort of theme, and that is walk as children of light. And just the importance that you see kind of woven through that whole passage. And they're not separate things. So walk in love is not contradictory to walk as children of light. They're both important and both working together. And so it's important that we would just see the value in walking as children of life, children of light, I should say. And what's interesting again is this is one of these topics where it's just like I mentioned last week, he's continuing on the same kind of theme where he's launching from some big kind of like gospel, theological truths, some kind of principle truths of who we are as believers and of the benefits we enjoy as believers, those timeless truths. And then he's saying, hey, that's going to be seen this week in how you live. It's going to be seen in your decisions. It's going to be seen in what you do and how you do it. And so it's both, as I said last week, it's both an amazing opportunity, but it's also a bit overwhelming when we think of just the significance of the decisions, the multiple decisions we'll make this week have a reflection on our relationship with Christ. They reflect the relationship that exists between us and Christ. And so it's really important just to think about them. So I moved to Canada in 2000. I came in 97 for summer, 98 for summer, and then got my paperwork in order. And in 2000, I moved here. And I moved and I landed with what was called, I think, permanent resident status, which is, if you're an immigrant, you know I was lucky, although lucky's the wrong word for it, obviously. Often when immigrants come, they get to come as visas and temporary workers and those kind of things, and then you have to renew that, renew it, and work your way up to get permanent residence. I think God knew that I was going to get homesick and that I would have booted back to Ireland. And he gave me no excuse. Whenever I landed, I had the permanent residence status. And so I could stay here for the rest of my life, but I was not a citizen. And then in about 2006, I'm now married. Melissa and I, we were married. We have, you know, it gets a little vague when you start thinking back to 2-3 kids somewhere in there. So there came that time where we decided that it was time for me to get my citizenship. And to be honest, it was more or less practical rather than any great ideological change. When you're in a marriage where one has a passport from one country and somebody has a passport from a different country and you do a lot of traveling, or in our case, we were doing a lot of traveling back to Ireland, back to the UK, it's a bit of a pain, especially when you're traveling with kids. That was really our main reason for traveling, was to see my family. And so when you get to customs in the UK, then of course I could buzz through because I had a European Union passport. Melissa and all the kids are like 200 people back in the line, and the kids were pretty young and we'd flown overnight. And so you can imagine we did that once or twice. And it was like, I think I need to become a citizen just so that I can get a Canadian passport and all those kind of things as well. Well, the time came for me to, you know, fill out the paperwork and apply for citizenship. I took a couple of courses from what I remember. I think it's actually got harder now to go through for citizenship. I still had to take a course and then take an exam, and I passed the exam, and then I got the date for my swearing-in ceremony. This was in Ontario. It was in Sudbury was where I was sworn in, and in some senses it was just a ceremony of contrasts, because you've got the judge and he's there in his full robes and he's talking very big about what this experience, that this is a privilege. And so on the one hand, you've got this kind of judge who is talking it up, and it's significant, and it is significant. I don't want to belittle it, but it's in this kind of like tired, worn out hotel. And so there's dated wallpaper and wonky lights, and then when it came time for the national anthem, the judge, who is flying solo this day, pulls out like an old tape player and hits play for the national anthem. And so it was just this weird, like, oh, this is kind of humorous, plus an amazing privilege. It is an amazing privilege just to have Canadian citizenship. One of the things that struck me, I was reminded of it this week when I came to this passage. So he starts to, in the middle of the ceremony, try to paint a picture of the opportunities that citizens of Canada have. And so here he is, this poor man, and he's trying to summarize for, I think it was about a dozen of us, all the opportunities you could have in Canada. And so, of course, he's aware that probably most of us haven't traveled that much. Most of us have sort of came to Northern Ontario. That's as far as we've traveled. And here he is with his words trying to paint the picture of every province and every opportunity and sort of the subtle differences between the provinces and, you know, the cultures and the people. And, hey, you could go out east and there's this culture over here and you go west. And here he is and he's trying to paint this like vast, glorious picture. And he's aware of himself that he is very limited in his time and in his words. And how do you paint? How do you try to describe the differences across Canada to a group of people who have never seen it? And so he's struggling, but he's doing his best. And of course, that was the big thing. If you have the opportunity as a Canadian after today, when you're sworn in and you've got your citizenship, go conquer the land kind of thing. And so he's talking about just that vast opportunity there is. And then sort of tagged on with that comes both then sort of some of the, you know, things to watch out for. And then also the responsibilities of citizenship and sort of the values of being part of Canada and, you know, high values on volunteering and community and these different things as well. And I was reminded of that, just as I say, when I came to this passage, because that's what Paul is doing. Even though he uses sort of very few words, he's painting with these few words this glorious picture of what the inheritance of the believers is, what you and me as believers, what we get to enjoy as children of God. And here he is trying to put that into words. And then not only that, but then we now, all these years later, are trying to read this passage, and even we are trying to figure out what Paul meant. And we're trying to put into words just a picture, or paint a picture that is just so broad and vast and deep, that how could we start to paint that picture with words of what God has done for us? And so I'm just reminded of that poor judge trying on that day to paint that picture. What makes it more interesting is, as I've already mentioned, is that he's writing it to people who are living in what would be a tough city, an ungodly city. If you're speaking of light and darkness, this would be a dark city and a dark culture. And yet what's interesting is he doesn't lower the standard. He doesn't say, "Oh, well, do your best. I know where you're living. You'll be good." That's not the tone. That even though he knows the darkness of that city, he still calls them to that pursuit and that continued pursuit of walking as children of light. A little bit about Ephesus. So Ephesus is the city where the Ephesians lived, the people who got this letter. It was a wealthy port city in the Roman province of Asia. It was called a mother city of Asia. It was one of the bigger cities. It had a strong influence over politics and commerce. There was the sort of a strong religious atmosphere. We'll get back to that in a minute. It was not only a wealthy port city, but it was also positioned near several key land routes in Western Asia Minor. So you've got major road network, and you've got also ships and boating and those kind of things as well. Because of the thriving economy, there was always kind of like this inflow of people from the country coming to try to make money. And so there was a lot of coming and going. It was also a center of learning and of government in the area. Josephus, he's a Jewish historian. He stated that there was a substantial Jewish population in the city. And then probably the big piece is that it was also a city that was committed to idol worship, committed to worshiping multiple gods. 50 deities, up to 50 deities were worshiped in this city. The most well-known was Artemis, also known as Diana. And there was this majestic temple. In fact, that temple was known as one of the wonders of the world at that time in that area. And so big, and the whole kind of lifestyle and the heartbeat of that city was based around the worship of Artemis. In fact, throughout the week, there was processions. So people would parade through the cities in the acts of worship. They would parade from the arenas, and they would parade up to the temple. Connected with the temple worship, there was lots of sexual immorality and prostitution. There was lots of not great things that went on in that city. And that's the context into which Paul is writing to these people and saying, hey, you are going to walk as children of light in that city. Now, also bear in mind that for some of them, this was their way of life. You read of that in Acts 19. Remember whenever the gospel takes root in this area, and all of a sudden the silversmiths, those who are making little trinkets connected with the temple worship, they're in a panic because they can see this gospel is taking hold and it's going to wipe them out of business. And so they create an uproar and end up causing a riot. And so you can imagine what it must have been like for some of the people he's writing to who would have grown up in that context, who would have grown up very comfortable with all the darkness as part of their life. And now he's saying, hey, no, you are going to be different. You're going to walk as light. You're going to walk as children of light in the darkness. And you see this connection, as I say, between the gospel truth and between ethics or the decisions. How are they going to live their lives? The priorities they're going to have, the things they will avoid and the things they will pursue. And it's interesting, you see this kind of language throughout the epistles, throughout this part of the New Testament, the different letters. You see often these kind of passages where there's that turn away from, turn towards. Don't do, make sure you do these things. And so there's this sort of like clear ethical understanding. Hey, don't do this, avoid it, don't be connected with it. And that's the language that you see here. And his expectation is that they would continue to grow in these things, that they would continue to learn, and that they would continue to grow more in terms of being children or walking as children of light. There's also a number of contrasts. If you look through it, I'm not going to bring them all out today, but there's a number of contrasts throughout this passage where he's just bringing out, hey, you once were this, or the value of what you had was this, but now it's this. And so it'd be worth, if you had time today or sometime, just look through and just make note of the contrasts. The other thing that's interesting as you work your way through it is there's a lot of emphasis put on our words and their words and the value of words and how we're to use our words. And so think about that as well. But three things that I want to just highlight in terms of what does it mean to walk as a child of light. First of all, we're to live as holy in an unholy world. We're to live as holy in an unholy world. Or I should put that better, maybe we're to live as holy people in an unholy world. And that's in verses 3-5 where I say you see that list of things to avoid and then some things that they are to pursue. And there's meant to be that difference, that contrast, that where they are light and they are surrounded by darkness. And so I want to just list some of these words and just explain them a little bit just so that we have an understanding of what it is that he's talking about. So you see there in verse 3, we'll start there, sexual immorality. It should be understood in the broadest sense. So it's a broad descriptive word describing any kind of sexual activity outside of a committed marriage relationship. Interestingly enough, I wanted to connect that. So that's the activity of sexual immorality. But then in Matthew 15, Jesus connects in a list of kind of sins, he connects them to our hearts. He says, from out of the heart come evil thoughts and murder and adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness and slander. And so Jesus is taking it actually from the activity and bringing it back and saying it flows out of our heart. But I think that Paul's point is for these people is that God has given them a new heart, that they enjoy newness of life in Christ. And so they shouldn't look as if that hasn't happened. There shouldn't be that pattern of sexual immorality. There shouldn't be that sort of similarities to other people. In fact, further down in the passage, we see just even the sort of description of what a healthy sexual relationship looks like. It says in Ephesians 5 and 31, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And I won't go there today for the sake of time, but there's just that sort of beautiful picture of marriage and what it represents in terms of Christ's relationship to the church. And the second thing you see is impurity, but it's not only in deeds, but also in our words and our thoughts and the intents of the heart. And that's where it gets kind of difficult, isn't it? Like, remember in the Gospels where it says, you know, if your arm causes you to sin, well, cut it off. But we recognize it so often that the depths of sin and the lure towards those things, it's not just a matter of cutting off our hand or poking out an eye or whatever it would be, but we recognize that in our heart of hearts, sometimes we're drawn to these things. And so we recognize this in terms of wanting to be pure. It's that wrestling through the very depths of our being to long for that purity and to strive after it. And then also there's covetousness or greed, different translations translated either one of those two words. Some people have said that that's sort of like a general term for greed, like sort of what we would describe like greedy for money or greedy for food or those kind of things. Others would say that it's more connected in the context of this passage. It's greedy for sexual immorality and greedy for impurity. I think both could imply, and both are certainly realities that we can face. This one quote I appreciated, it said, in the Greco-Roman world, the pursuit of wealth and material gain was common, and greed was often seen as a vice that disrupted social harmony. The New Testament writers, influenced by the Jewish teaching, they viewed this as contrary to the values of the kingdom of God, which emphasized contentment, generosity, and trust in God's provision. And that's one of the heart issues of what's going on, sort of like below the surface, that in each of these vices, in each of these things that they're being told to avoid, at its root, it connects to their relationship with God. That when we are greedy for something else, it shows that we're discontent with what God has given us. Or even there where it connects as sexual immorality to idols, and where it says that it's so often connected, where in this case it really was idolatry and sexual immorality were going hand in hand as they worshiped Artemis. But so often in terms of this area of sin, it's because we have created something in our minds. We have created something that we essentially want to worship. And so it leads us away from what God has given us and how he has led us. It's also interesting, just that little phrase, it must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. That little phrase, be named among you, is kind of a weird one. It's not a very common way to use that word for named. And really what the point is, I think, is that as somebody would come into the gathering of Christians, they shouldn't be able to look at what's going on and say, hey, that's a group of thieves. Or those people are a group of liars. They shouldn't be able to name us, to give us a name that's characterized with a sinful thing, because we've already been given a name. That's already there in the passage. The name that we've been given is that of saint. And so he's saying to them, you've already been given that name, saint. Be worthy of that name, saint. Live out your life in light of what that means. Because that is your name saint, or the name saint, is connected with your character. It's speaking of being God's people. It's speaking of grace that he has bestowed upon us. It's speaking of his love and of his faithfulness and his care for us. And so he's saying, hey, no one should be able to come in and say, you guys should be named liars or thieves or whatever it would be. Don't, it shouldn't be named. There shouldn't be a character quality that's associated with these things that would fit with the behavior that you're doing, but rather, you are saints. And then the next verse 4 there, you see the next one's filthiness, foolish talk, and crude joking. So conduct that is shameful, disgraceful, debased, and obscene. And then foolish talk was silly talk, perhaps specifically connected to the sexual sins, therefore meaning salacious talk. Crude joking, again, it seems to be likely a way of degrading and jesting. And so we just need to be careful. Now, what's really interesting is that we need to be careful, because there's obviously Paul is not saying that all humor is bad, or he's not trying to outrule or outlaw laughing and humor. We recognize that humor is a gift from God, But what he's recognized is that there's an easy path. There's an easy way whereby these things can go from being something that is healthy and something that is honoring to the Lord and can move to something that would dishonor God, something that would sort of bear testimony about Jesus and something that would take away from that testimony. And so he's saying, hey, be careful that in your humor, be careful that in your talking, be careful that in your decisions and in your lifestyle, that it doesn't go towards or into filthiness. Be careful with those things. And it's that little thing which is out of place. That's the picture that he uses there in four. So what's he trying to get across? It's just something that would be so random, something that would be so unexpected, something that wouldn't fit, something that just would shock you where you go, what is going on with this? It would make no sense. This is maybe not quite the right illustration, but if I invited you over to my house for lunch and we cook the food in the kitchen and then I give everybody a plate of food and then we walk through the dining room and then we walk down into the garage and then I say, hey, sit in the box and sit in the floor and we're going to eat our lunch in the garage. You go, okay, whatever. But you'd be surprised. Why wouldn't you eat your food in the kitchen? It would be out of place that you would walk right past the dining room table and eat in the garage. Like that would seem strange. And that's his point. He's saying those things, it's just weird. It would seem strange. It would be just jarring that those things would be normal in a believer's life. And so he's saying, hey, it would be out of place. It doesn't fit. And the reason it doesn't fit is because remember I was saying where it's connected again to our relationship with God and what he has done for us. Well, then you see, he then encourages them to land on thanksgiving. He encouraged them to be a thankful people. And it's really the response of a people who are the children of light. But it's also that protector when we do face these temptations, when we do face these challenges, where thanksgiving is going to guard us from maybe the entitlement that we give ourselves to pursue these temptations and these sins. I couldn't help but think of, remember that lady where she comes into this house, this is in the Gospels, and as she comes into that house, she bends at Jesus' feet and she wipes his feet with her tears and dries his feet with her hair. And it's this act of love. And Jesus explains to the host of the house that this lady obviously loves him so very much and has been forgiven much. And it's this posture we see in that act and in the posture of this lady, just a reminder that she got it. She understood that she'd been forgiven. She understood what she had been forgiven for. And she understood the necessity of thankfulness. And so too, again, as we think of walking as children of light, we think of that posture of thankfulness and how it will guard us. Then the second contrast we see is there in verse 6-8. We're to live as children of light, not sons of disobedience. So you have verse 8 speaks of the children of light. And then just before that, in verse 6, it says, because of these, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. So you have this sort of family term, sons, and this kind of like picture of sort of brothers or sons together. They're pursuing or identified by their disobedience. And then, as I say in verse 8, contrasted with, we are not part of the sons of disobedience, but rather we are children of light. And so again, you see this contrast that's supposed to be jarring. And it's really that same, just that reminder of a massive transition that has happened. Because it wasn't that we were born children of light. It wasn't that that's where we started, but rather we were born, as it were, sons of disobedience. We were born that way. We were pursued and content in that way. And then rather have been transferred over to the kingdom of light. And as we are to live as children of light, we see there he gets on to let no one deceive you with empty words. And this awareness that we can be deceived, this awareness that it would seem that what was going on right there in Ephesus was that there was some within that group and they were trying to give, they would speak and say, don't worry too much about your sin. Don't worry too much about whether you know, the lines are a bit blurred. Don't worry what's going on. And so Paul writes and he says, look, don't be deceived. Don't be tricked. We don't like to be tricked. We don't like to be scammed, to use maybe more of a modern term. But Paul has sent them, you are being scammed. These words that are being spoken to you are not trustworthy, but they're empty words. They're not words that can be relied on, but they're words that should be discarded. And so as children of light, we do not want to be deceived. And then he reminds them, why are they empty? For because of these things, the wrath of God comes on the sons of disobedience. And that reality and that truth, that God's judgment will come on sin, will come on those who have not accepted him as Savior and Lord. And then, of course, not only are they to be watching and not being deceived, but they're not to be partners with him. And his point is this, that they are partners with Christ. He's already gone through it. We didn't look at it in this study, but if you go back to like Ephesians 2 and even Ephesians 1, you realize the plans that God has for the Ephesians, and he kind of keeps bringing that out of how God has called them and God has a purpose and God is in essence a partner with them. And so he says to these people, don't be partners. Don't be partners with the sons of disobedience. Don't fit in because you are indeed children of light. I wanted to think a little bit more about deceiving with empty words. There's just that awareness. And I'm not sure if essentially the text brings the first one out, but just this reality of sometimes, how are we deceived with empty words? I think sometimes we can be deceived with the empty words that we speak. Empty words that we speak into our temptations. When we're going through and maybe tempted and want something and want to justify a certain action or behavior, it can be easy sometimes when we're lured and we can deceive ourselves and pursue after these things. And so we want to be watching about our own empty words. I say, be watching against the empty words of others, whether that's a friend who says, hey, as a Christian, you can do this or don't do that, or you should do this or you shouldn't do that. Again, it's good to have friends. It's good to have friends who are Christians, but just be aware that if it doesn't line up with the scriptures, we need to be careful. And then, of course, in terms of empty words, sometimes it's Satan, where he whispers them to us, wanting us to be led astray, wanting us to pursue something or engage in something or not do something that would not be fitting, that would not be appropriate, that would not be the right thing for the children of light to do. And so we see we are not to become partners with them because we are light in the Lord. At one time darkness, now light in the Lord, another contrast that we see. And then the last thing I want to look at this morning is just that we're to live and to bear the fruit of light and not the unfruitful works. This is sort of verse 9 to 14 are therein. And you see it there in verse 9, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true, right? And so we get this. Like it's a picture of something that's healthy, something to be desired, something that is of value, right? Something that is, the qualities of that fruit are good. It's good and it's right and it's true. And so again, when you think of it, with the calling that's on our lives as children of light is that we would bear that fruit. Galatians would use like the imagery of the fruit of the Spirit. It's the same kind of concept where we're seeing what it means as God's people to be bearing fruit. But it's in contrast to fruitlessness, verse 11. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness. See, there's that contrast. And the reality is in the here and now, sometimes the works of darkness can appear very appealing and pleasurable. But yet mark what the scriptures say, where it says that over time we will see that they're unfruitful and that they do not bring any lasting good, but rather lasting pain. And so he sent them, look, as children of light, you are to pursue that fruit. Well, how do you do that? It's by discerning what is pleasing to the Lord. It's by discerning what is pleasing to the Lord there in verse 10. And so again, it's that daily pursuit of what will honor him. Of course, it's again, this is us living out what God has done in our lives. This is us in light of the relationship, in light of that we are light, our children of light, that then we live these things out. But then also that fruit is seen in how we relate to others. You see there where it goes on to speak about we are to expose the deeds of darkness, verse 11 and then 12 and even a little bit into 13 where he speaks about light being able to expose darkness. I am not that old. However, flashlight technology in my lifetime is night and day difference, excuse the pun. It's amazing. Whenever, like, I cannot believe, I'm not that invested in this. I'm making a point, but I'm not, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about flashlights. But I remember back in the day, you know, I remember my boss had a flashlight when we would go and check animals in the farm and stuff. But that thing had a battery the size of like a shoebox. And you would hold the sucker up and like you'd be tired after a bit. But it was an amazing light. Of course, we never remember to plug the thing in. So you'd get out there and boom, it'd be darkness. But even for us, when we go camping with our youth group at church, and most of us had, you know, $2 flashlights that lasted for all of 30 minutes and then the batteries were done. And even the bulbs were not ever super bright. But there was always one person. There was always that one person who seemed to have spent more money, who seemed to get a brighter flashlight. Oh, we were always so envious. And then now we've got lights on our phones and LED lights and the batteries seem to last forever. And you can see here, he's speaking about the power of light to expose the dark, to make things visible. And so there's this reality in which he is saying to these believers, as they are to live or walk as children of light, that they are exposing the darkness even in what they do. They are exposing those unfruitful works of darkness. It seems to speak more to believers together, where we are to kind of encourage one another. And as we live in the light, I think people round about us, they see just that light and they're drawn to it. Our other believers are drawn to it as well. I wanted to sort of land this part just by that little section, awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. There's that, it's meant to be an early hymn. And really, I wanted to land on that because two reasons why. One, because I think that's where the passage goes, but also because I think it's important that we would understand that Christ will shine on you part. Because the reality is, as we are seeking to walk as children of light, the reality is, as we seek to live this out, I have no doubt that even here this morning, there are those who are probably feeling pretty defeated by this or feeling pretty overwhelmed by maybe the temptations and the battles in which they deal with. And so just again, to bring it back to the reality of Christ, that as we come to him and we need his grace, that he will shine on you. This last part where you see that kind of concept of light exposing the darkness and Christ shining on you. I was saying in the first service, I had that experience probably 15, 16. I was taken to a youth meeting, not a youth meeting that we normally went to. It was kind of out of the blue, and we went to this youth meeting, and the speaker that night was speaking on kind of on, you know, that passage on how God always provides a way of escape, and when we face temptation, find that way of escape. And afterwards, I had spoken with somebody, and he prayed with me, but he didn't know. Well, by the time we were done talking, he knew. But the reality was that at that point, I was just really struggling with just an area of sin in my life. And probably struggling with several things, struggling with the sin itself, but struggling with the guilt of it and struggling with the fact that I just was defeated by this sin. And the reality was for me was in chatting to this brother, this brother in the Lord, as he shared, I can just describe it just like this, where as he counseled and as he brought forth the scriptures and as he listened and as his attitude and these different things, it was just very clear to me that God's light shone into that situation. And just even the comfort of, first of all, recognizing that in my mind, I was convinced that I was the only one who ever struggled with sin. And so for this brother to be able to say, whoa, you got that one wrong. But more than that, for him just to speak and bring light into that darkness. And just knowing that it was not like the problems were gone like that. But I think what it was, it gave me the tools to walk better. It gives me the tools to recognize the importance of light, to recognize the importance of light piercing the darkness, even in my own life. Emmanuel, as we wrap it up this morning, we want to recognize that just like that judge who was saying, hey, look, the whole of Canada is before you. Go, just go and do what you want to do and be what you want to be. Paul would say to the Ephesians, you are children of light. That is a glorious truth. a glorious truth in which you are going to live out this week. And so we are to walk, or we are to live this week in the light of that truth. We are to walk not as fitting in with the darkness, not as fitting in with the world, but we walk as children of light. And so that's our prayer this morning, just that we'd be able to do that well, and we'd be able to do that faithfully.